From time to time, we hear today regarding our present-day educational system that many of the graduating seniors can't read and they can't write and they cannot do simple mathematics. Some of you may remember the song of yesteryear that went, school days, dear old golden rule days. And it mentioned reading and writing and arithmetic. These are considered today to be the basic three areas of education that all people need to learn. But of the three, it seems that arithmetic is the hardest. I know it's for myself, I have found this to be the case. Now, I can add and subtract, and I can divide and multiply without much difficulty. But when it comes to algebra and calculus and trigonometry, that's a bit much for my feeble brain. And probably one of the first things a parent teaches a child is to count. You ask some little child, how old are you? And immediately one finger will go up or two fingers will go up, meaning I know 1 year old and I know I'm 2 years old. And it's a proud day when parents can say, Johnny or Susie, count to 10 for uncle or aunt or grandma. Then when the child can count to 100, that's almost like a time to celebrate. And boy, when the child can count to 1,000, you know, we can really rejoice over that. You know, in God raising His own children, I think you know this, maybe you don't, but I think we should realize that the first thing He begins to try to do with His child is to teach them how to count. Now, I know that probably doesn't make much sense to you, but God's children need to learn to count. And what's so amazing is that we run across Christians, which of course are God's children, who have been saved 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, who have never learned to count. Never learned how to count. Now, I know I've probably lost most all of you this morning, but I'll pick you up in a minute and you'll understand what I'm talking about. And I believe you'll agree with me, most of God's children cannot count. Recently, my wife and I took on the chore of replacing a sink faucet. Of course, we went down and bought the new replacement faucet, and we opened the box, and in there were all the pieces and the parts. And I said, what's this for? What do you do with this? How does this work? And where does this go? And it's a good thing that my wife and I had learned to count. You've heard the old saying, when all else fails, read the instructions. Well, when you begin to read the instructions, they say, go to number one, go to number two, and go to number three, and go to number four. Actually, we had to know how to count to seven in reading these instructions because there were seven numbers to look at, and you had to know which one number is right from the other. So we were able to count to seven. And so we'd read step one, step two, step three, and we would follow the numbers in installing the faucet. But from my past experience and efforts at doing a little bit of plumbing, I have found that you have to know how to do more than count the cost of the faucet. I know there are some additional possibilities and probabilities that I better count on in installing this faucet. One, of course, would be trying to figure out a way to stop all the leaks that weren't supposed to come about as a result of my plumbing efforts. Now, this is the kind of counting that I am referring to in this sermon. It's the kind of accounting that's associated with possibilities and probabilities of some decision or action that you make. On several occasions, we read of people who came to Jesus and said, we want to follow you. And He said, well, let's begin by teaching you to count. Luke chapter 14, verse 27 to 29. Now, here are people who came to Christ and they wanted to follow Him. And He said, whosoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Then He gives this illustration about counting. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sits not down first and counts the cost, whether he has sufficient material, energy, effort, determination, and so forth to finish the tower. Lest after he hath laid the foundation and failed to count all the cost, he will not be able to finish the tower. And then everybody will laugh at him and mock him for his stupidity, and I'm going to add this, in the area of counting. They would say, hey, this guy can't even count. He's come up way short in his pocketbook. Now, Jesus saying, as this is an illustration, those who come after me must learn to count. They must learn to count the cost involved in following me. And this is the kind of counting most Christians yet have not learned how to do. How do you count the cost? That's not the only cost you're supposed to learn how to count. And we'll see that in a few minutes. It's not that we can't do this kind of counting. It's just that we sometimes don't want to make the effort. Or we might miscalculate. Or we put it off till too late. Or maybe it's just possible this morning that we really never have learned how to count the cost of serving Christ, or count the cost of any action or word or thought or deed that we might do. Let me give you a simple illustration. And I think all of you have probably gone through this at one time or another in your life. You decided that the old car you have is a clunker, and it's faded, and it rattles, and it's getting old, and you like the smell of a new one, and you like the looks of a new one. And so you go down to the showroom with your wife or by yourself, and you're determined you're going to buy this certain kind of automobile. You got your heart set on it. You can almost taste the aroma of that new car. All your mind dwells on, day in and day out, going down to that showroom and finding the best deal on that car that you now desire to have. And so you shop around, and finally, let us say, you find the best deal in town. And just for our sake of understanding this, let's say it's a $20,000 car. That's the best deal you can get. And boy, it's the color you want. It's got all the accessories you want. It's just what you want. And you say, boy, it's going to be tight with me financially. I mean, I can make it, but it's going to really be stretching things a little bit. But I sure want that car, and I can make the payments. So you sit down to the seller and say, I'll buy. And he comes in there finally with the papers you sign, and you notice down there, it's not $20,000, it's now $22,500. And you say, hey, wait a minute. You told me $20,000. And the salesman looks at you kind of funny. He said, yeah, it is. But don't you realize you have to pay sales tax? And you have to pay registration fee? And you have to buy a license plate? Well, that's going to be $2,500 more. You see, the person hadn't counted on that. Not only that, when he gets ready to call the insurance company to make a transfer of insurance, he's told by the agent, well, that's going to raise your car insurance so much a month. And the guy says, well, man, I hadn't counted on that. Now, the picture that began so simple, that was so appealing, now begins to get a little bit bigger. And the picture now has things in it that's not quite so appealing. If $20,000 is going to put a strain on you financially, my fella, just think what $2,500 more plus insurance is going to do to you. I mean, you better enlarge your picture from you sitting in that car just driving around town smiling and saying, look at me in my car. You better expand your painting a little bit. You better expand your conception a little bit. You better expand your picture a little bit. You might get more realistic in your picture. You better add some things. You better broaden your view. Broaden the possibilities and the probabilities of what's going to happen if you go ahead and buy the car with the additional expenses you hadn't counted on. Will you be able to pay for it now? and keep your house payments up and keep buying food and keep paying utilities and all the other things that you have to do. I mean, is this strain now going to affect your marriage? Is it could it possibly create a divorce? I mean, what kind of hardships could this deal do to you now if you go ahead and proceed? Can you vision in your mind the possibilities and the probabilities of what might happen if you go ahead and buy that car, knowing now that it's really way beyond your means? You better count, fella, count the cost of that car. I mean, it could affect your children, it could affect your in-laws and outlaws, it could affect a lot of folks. I mean, are you really sure now this is the smart thing to do? Oh, I know you want the car and you got the itch for the new automobile, but you better do some counting. Now, that's not 1, 2, 3, unless you want to say 1, can I pay for it? 2, can my marriage survive? 3, can I mentally stand the pressure of not being able to buy things? I mean, you better count the cost, fellas. Now, first, you see, the man had just what I call a narrow view. All he saw was himself sitting in that new car and enjoying the pleasures of driving it. That was what I call the narrow view. But as his view begins to broaden, he begins to get a better picture of what that's going to involve. It could eventually create a real nightmare and a mess, and he could have the car repossessed, and he could lose his house. I mean, now the picture is a broad picture. Now, if you're familiar with the Bible, you know the words narrow and broad call to mind a certain word of Christ, or saying of Christ, Matthew 7:13-14. Enter ye in at the straight gate. For wide is the gate, or broad, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go in or on that broad road. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leads unto eternal life, and there be few that travel and enjoy and find the narrow way. It'd be easy to conclude from reading these words from Christ that everything broad is bad and everything narrow is good. In most cases, that would probably be correct, but I would say at least, though, we have one exception here. And that exception is when it comes to learning how to count. Now, I don't want to confuse you at this moment, but I want to try to follow my line of thinking here. Those on the narrow road that leads to eternal life must learn how to take in the broad view. And those on the broad road will be taught by the devil to take only the narrow view. And you would normally say, well, those on the broad road have the broad view, and those on the narrow road have the narrow view. No, it doesn't work that way. Now you learn how to count. Those on the broad way always are by Satan's desires inspired to take the narrow view. And those on the narrow road, traveling with God, are always inspired by Him to take the broad view. And I'll illustrate what I'm talking about in a few seconds. Again, those on the broad road are traveling under the directions of the devil, which lead to destruction of a person's life. And they say this, it would be almost next to impossible for the devil to lead his people down the broad road that leads to destruction unless he can persuade them always to take only the narrow view. And I'll add this, it would be almost next to impossible for God to keep His children on the narrow road unless He could persuade them to always take the broad view. And so Satan's number one strategy is to get his followers to always take the narrow road. And there are many illustrations of this in the Bible, and I'll get to a few of those in just a minute. Those led by the narrow view never learn to count. Many travel the narrow road are tricked by Satan And they too have the narrow view, and they backslide and they sin continually. They too have never learned to count. That is, if they do count, they can only count to number one, not just what they see with the narrow view. Before we look at some of the Bible characters that illustrates this narrow view and broad view, I want to relate the story of an incident in my boyhood. I do not recollect clearly how old I was, but I was a young teen, and I was out hunting quail with my father and two other men I did not know, but my father knew. And we were walking along, and my father and I were kind of up on a rise, kind of a little hill, like not a hill, but just a mound of dirt. We were walking along the upper ridge, and to our left, there were the other two hunters, and they were kind of down in a little, a lower area where stream bed. Let's put it that way, dried out stream bed. And they were in line with us. We were all walking about the same distance apart, but we were on a levee rise, and they were down in the stream bed. It was dry, and we were walking along. And about that time, if you ever gone quail hunting, quail's a funny bird. They're sitting on the ground, and you almost step on them before they'll fly. And when they do, they scare you. You haven't expected this thing. All for just a split second, you're frightened, you know. Here, these birds take off in front of you. Well, that's what happened this day. These birds just jumped up right in front of my daddy and myself. And my dad told me, well, now, you go ahead and take the shot. Well, when I go hunting, I don't anymore, but when I went hunting, you know, a bird had a real good chance of survival if I was the one who was taking the shot. I wasn't too good at hitting what I aimed at. Also, hunting was a 410 pump shotgun. Now, that may not mean anything to a lot of you people, but a 410 is the smallest shotgun made. It doesn't kick when you shoot. That's one of the reasons I had one. But also, when you have the smallest shotgun made, it's got the smallest shell. And it won't shoot as far, and there's not as many little old BB shots inside the shell. And the pattern when you shoot doesn't spread out as far. So when you shoot a 410, it's almost like shooting a rifle. You have to be almost on the bird, aiming exactly where you need to be for this shotgun to hit the bird. So it's not the kind you just aim in the general direction of the bird and boom, and all these little old BB shells fan out about 7 feet wide, and so you got a 7 foot area, that you can make arrow. Not with a 410, you may have a foot that you can make an arrow in. That's about it. And so the quail got up, you know, and my dad. And by the way, when you have a 410, you just don't shoot in the area of the bird. You got to aim. Which means you got to get the barrel and you got to sight that bird in that barrel, and you got about a second or 2 seconds to do all this stuff. And so I was got to aim, and when you aim anything, folks, your focus becomes very narrow. Now follow me in the word narrow. It becomes very narrow, and all I saw was the end of my barrel and that sight, and trying to get that on one of those birds. I mean, I was oblivious to anything around me whatsoever. Now, quail's not a bird that'll get up and just fly straight and give you something easy to shoot at. A quail may swerve left. He may circle right. He may go back over your head. A quail is unpredictable. So here I am with my 410 trying to sight that bird, and sure enough, he swerves to the left. Not he, but the whole bunch of them do. They all turn left. Zoom! Going back around to my left. Go back behind me. So, of course, I'm sighting these birds, and I'm falling around, you know. And the birds swoop down a little low, and now they're about the same level as these men on my left. Now, with the narrow view, folks, all I'm seeing is just a little bit of a bird and the sky behind him. And as I get to my left, my eyes happen to see those men. Now, if I'd have pulled that trigger, I'd have shot those men, because those birds now were about head high of those men, flying in between them. But you see, as I looked around, my view broadened. And I said, whoops, I better not shoot this gun. Now, had I not had a broad view, Can you realize the probabilities and the possibilities that could have developed at that moment I'd have fired that gun? They were close enough, I'd have hit them. Could have put their eyes out, could have killed them, maimed them for life. What would that have done to their families? What would that have done? I mean, I could have totally wrecked their lives, and in one sense mine too, had I not quickly had a broad view. Had I remained with that narrow view on looking only at that bird, I'd have shot those men. Well, I got a broader view of the picture, and of course I didn't pull the trigger. The men were all diving to the ground, realizing what I might do. And of course, I didn't do it, and I thank God for that. But it illustrates you to me the narrow view and the broad view. In the narrow view, all I could see was, boy, I'm going to get me a quail. In the broad view, you're going to get more than a quail. You're going to get a disaster. You're going to get regrets and chagrin and sorrow. You need a bigger picture. And God gave me one at that moment. You see, the broad view prevented me from even attempting to shoot that quail. I forgot about that quail. And my only concern then was, do not shoot that gun. Now, let me give you some illustrations of what I'm talking about in the Bible. The Bible is full of illustrations of men who have the narrow view and never learn to count to the point that they get a broad view. And had they gotten the broad view, chances are they would have never said or done the thing they did when all they had was the narrow view. And let's just begin with Adam and Eve. What did Satan do? He took all the things around Eve, which is the broad view, all right? Everything good, everything there, the paradise, I mean, everything was perfect. And Satan said, let's focus all of our view, let's narrow down our view, Eve, to one thing, the forbidden fruit. Now, there was a million things in that garden, but Satan said, no, let's narrow down our focus, and let's just focus on one thing, and let's just ignore the existence of anything else in the garden. I want you just to think about one thing. I want you to get very narrow in your thinking. Don't think about Adam. Don't think about anything, but just think about the pleasure that you'll get from eating the forbidden fruit. And the knowledge and the benefit, I mean, you owe yourself this, Eve, this benefit that you're going to get. Go ahead. And Eve narrowed down her focus to just one little bitty thing. I don't know how big this fruit was. Say it was a couple of inches. I mean, he narrowed her view down to about 2 inches. And that's all she could see. That's all she could think about in the garden. And so he said, you're important, Eve. You deserve self-gratification is number one aim in your life. I mean, this can bring you great pleasure and benefit and delight. And so he narrowed her focus down to the fruit. Now, God would say to her, Naive, you need a broad view of this. I want you to get your eyes off that one little old forbidden fruit. I want you to look around the garden. What's going to happen to your garden, Eve, if you eat that fruit? Do you know? And look at your husband over there, Adam. What's going to happen to him, Eve, if you eat the fruit? And Eve, I'm walking in the garden and we have a relationship. What is going to happen to the relationship you and I have, Eve, if you eat the fruit? Eve, what can you possibly lose if you eat the fruit? Now, you may gain some self-gratification in getting what you want, but I mean, as you view the whole perspective, and you know, Eve, your name means mother, what's this going to do to your children? I mean, Eve, can you count beyond the moment gratification? Can you count the cost of what's going to happen if you eat that fruit? I mean, Eve, open your eyes and look all around you. Do you like the garden? You're going to lose it. You like the pleasant surround? Do you possibly consider that something could happen bad to this earth? Eve, if you broadened your view and began to count the probabilities and the possibilities, I mean, do you really think it's worth a bite of the forbidden fruit? Do you realize how much damage you're going to cause, how much ruin and wreckage, and how much sorrow? Our first son, commits murder. I mean, either you realize the floodgates of sorrow that you're opening up, get your eyes off of the little narrow vision and take the broad look, Eve. Now, had Eve been able to count, poor woman couldn't count. And all she could say, I can just count to one. The only thing important to me is eating that forbidden fruit. And God says, now, wait a minute, Eve. You open your eyes and get the broad view. I mean, not just what's in the garden, but look all around you. And what's going to happen tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day? Eve, do you realize that I warned you this is a tree of death? Now, had Eve taken the broad view, I really personally feel like people that she would not have eaten the fruit. If Satan can get your focus on the narrow view, all it says is satisfy whatever desire you have at the moment. And don't you count any cost. Don't consider any circumstances whatsoever. Just get right now what it is you want and forget about everything else. And God says, no, no, to His children. I want you to think about everything else. I want you to stretch your imagination as far as you can. You count. Think about David and Bathsheba. Same thing. David would have never done what he did. He had the narrow view. All he saw was Bathsheba. That's all he could see. And God said, oh, David, take the broad view. Can you see the devastation it's going to bring to Israel and to you and the baby and the Bathsheba and your own children? I mean, think, David. Get the broad view. Folks, we need to learn to count as Christians.